Okay, Hillary, are we ready to get back to business here then?
Yes.
I believe we are.
Okay, I'll turn this back to you then, Peter, to introduce the next part, or Andrew, who's doing that.
Yeah, next we're going to hear from Dr. Werner Kurtz with the Natural Resources Canada, Canadian Forest Service.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Thank you, board members, for inviting me and for organizing this. I want to speak briefly today. Let me just set my timer here. I want to speak briefly today about global carbon flux and forest considerations. I've been asked to start with a high-level overview and then speak about the forest carbon budget model that we use and the climate mitigation opportunities that we're addressing with this model. My name is Werner Kurtz. I'm a senior research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service, as was introduced earlier. We cannot keep global warming below 2 degrees centigrade without significant contributions from the land sector. And the reason I make this statement is because the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, has identified that net negative emissions are required later this century to stay below 2 degrees. And what that means is that the human-induced removals from the atmosphere must be greater than our emissions. Around the world, government expectations are high that the land sector and the forest sector in particular will contribute these future removals. The special report on 1.5 degrees that was published in 2018 has identified that the pathways to staying below 1.5 or 2 degrees must involve a dramatic and simultaneous reduction in fossil fuel emissions and an increase in land sinks. The IPCC laid out various pathways. I'll just give you one element of the examples with the four diagrams. And what you see from left to right is that as we delay our emission reductions from fossil fuels, we have to have greater and greater land sinks in the future in order to keep warming to below 1.5 degrees. And to put things in perspective, the area of bioenergy plantations required in the rightmost scenario here is about 724 million hectares of bioenergy plantations. That's about 95% of the area of the lower 48 states in the United States. More importantly, this also involves bioenergy with carbon capture and storage and the capacity to actually remove CO2 from smokestacks and store it below ground is very limited at the moment. The IPCC report really highlighted that every ton of greenhouse gas emission matters, every year matters, and every degree of warming matters. But it also identified that we still have choices. The IPCC followed up in 2019 with a special report on climate change, of which I was one of the lead authors, in which we identified risks, opportunities, and synergies for carbon removal through the land sector and discussed the impacts of such actions on desertification, land degradation, and food security. The report really highlights the benefits of sustainable land and forest management and identifies that not all of the activities that are aimed at reducing future greenhouse gas emissions require land. They're also demand-driven diet, for example, choices that we can make in the future. One key message from this process is that we must not allow expected future land sinks to become an excuse to avoid reducing fossil fuel emissions now. Globally, forests are taking up about 30% of the emissions from fossil fuel burning and cement manufacture and those from land use change, primarily deforestation in the tropics. In other words, more than half of the carbon that is emitted by humans is taken up by forests and oceans, and only 44% globally is remaining in the atmosphere. So we basically get a 50% discount on all our emissions. But the big question is whether the sink in forests globally can be sustained or ideally even enhanced, which is necessary to achieve net negative emissions. In Canada, we have developed a National Forest Carbon Monitoring and Accounting and Reporting System that allows us to do exactly the kinds of things that Glenn and Todd have spoken about in the last hours. We have a integrated system that allows us and is being used since 2006 to report annually on our greenhouse gas emissions and removals. And we use the same system to also support emissions trends reporting, scientific research and analysis of mitigation and adaptation strategies. And I will speak more about the system and the tools behind it in the remainder of this presentation. At the core of it is a model that I started working on in 1989. Actually, Mark Harmon, who was mentioned earlier, was one of the people who came to the very first workshop when we designed some of the approaches. And it is a tool that is designed to allow forest managers to assess the impacts or the implications of various forest carbon management strategies aimed at increasing sinks or reduced sources. The model is freely available. It's comprised of a user's guide, databases, and tutorials. We make all of this freely available. Over the last years, I've trained over 700 people in 31 workshops around the world. The model is available in five different languages. And we have users in many countries around the world, in industry, academia, agencies, and NGOs. And we have a full-time extension forester who basically provides training and support for users. Glenn very nicely explained earlier today how the US calculates the greenhouse gas fluxes. It is or stock changes. It is based on a stock difference method where the average changes over a 5 or 10 year remeasurement period are observed and calculated. One of the consequences of that approach is that the fires from the emissions in this year will not really appear in your inventory unless you use auxiliary data until many years in the future. In fact, the first time fire impacts will be measured is only 1/10 of the panels will be measured. We use a different approach. We use the other approach identified by the IPCC. It's called a gain loss method. And what we do is we take an initial forest inventory, say in 1990, the start of the reporting period. We calculate annual growth, and then we calculate losses from decomposition, disturbances, and land use changes. And we then calculate the ending forest inventory, and we repeat this process in an annual time step. And what that means is that the gain-loss method gives us much greater interannual variability of emissions, but it also allows us to attribute these emissions to their causes. And I'll show you examples of that in a moment. But there's a second important consequence of this methodological choice. The stock difference method, when it comes to projections, would require the measurements of future conditions. And of course, by definition, we cannot do that. We can't measure the forests in 2030 or 2040. With a gain loss method, what we do is we use these annual activity data, say our annual harvest time series, and we simply extrapolate that into the future. And that allows us to obtain a seamless transition between the reported past and the projected future emissions. So if you look at that simple diagram, it's just an example. From 1990 to 2009 in this example, are the actual data. And then going forward, we look at two scenarios, the red one and the blue one, and there's a seamless transition. Every year, we replace the projected time series, the first year in the projected time series, with the actual data. And if you want, close the zipper between the two scenarios. These are methodological choices that were made historically, and they're implemented in our two different countries based on the available data. We do not have the advantage of the fantastic FIA system that exists in the United States. And so by necessity, we had to take a different approach, but it turns out that approach has other advantages, and Grant Domke and I frequently talk about these issues. And there's clearly an understanding that there needs to be and is ongoing convergence of our methods to take advantage of the strengths of both of these approaches. In general, what we do with our model is we stratify the forests into classes. We identify, and these are stratified by species, site productivity, management type, ownership, and other criteria. We then use existing forest inventory information, and in some cases, remote sensing data to populate the different strata. We use empirical growth and yield models to calculate the growth dynamics of the stands, so-called yield curves. And we use a process modeling approach of modeling litter fall, tree mortality, disturbance impacts, and so on, to estimate the dynamics in dead organic matter pools and soil carbon. We represent a wide range of natural disturbances, forest management activities, and land use changes, and we have a variety of data sources to do that. This model is widely published in the literature. There are many different publications on the descriptions of the model, its validation, uncertainty analyses, and example applications in Canada and many other countries, including the United States. The model is also applied in Canada's greenhouse gas inventory reporting, and that is subject to the annual review by the UNFCCC teams. The model is also used in 26 EU countries, not for reporting except for Ireland, but to do reference level calculations and other methodologically consistent approaches for 26 EU countries. Fundamentally, you know, I don't have time to go into what is a three-day training course on the model, but you know, we represent above and below ground biomass for softwood and hardwood species in a total of 10 biomass pools. We have a wide range of dead organic matter pools from standing dead trees to their branches, and then a series of dead organic matter and litter pools that have different inputs and decay rates, and then the slow dead organic matter pools, which would be the humified layer in the forest floor and the soil organic carbon. We then, it's basically a data integration framework. We use forest inventory and growth and yield data, disturbance modeling, management activity data, land use change data, and ecological modeling parameters like volume to biomass conversion equations, etc. And we integrate that all over time and space. Here's an example of the results for British Columbia. The x-axis shows you the years from 1990 to 2018. This would be the reporting for the 2020 reporting year that was published in April of this year. The area, the bars with the right axis are the millions of hectares of land that are disturbed by these different activities. And the line with reference to the left side shows the net balance of the forest sector, not including harvested wood products, for forest land, remaining forest land, and all gases. And so what you see is that in the 1990s, up to about 2001, 2002, our forests were a carbon sink, and a fairly strong carbon sink that diminished from then on as the mountain pine beetle outbreak ravaged throughout British Columbia. The sink flipped to a source, in particular in the last 2 years of the reporting period, 2017 and 18, when we had 1.2 and 1.3 million hectares of forest burned. That's about 3 million acres in round numbers. So very clearly, you can see the interannual variability associated with its drivers. You see the trends due to the mountain pine beetle outbreak, and you see how it has changed over time. This is the same graph in light blue at the bottom, but now I added the annual emissions from harvested wood products to it. And you can see that the thin black line are the annual emissions from harvested wood products using methods very similar to what Todd described a short while ago. And the red line now is the combined impact of harvested wood products and emissions and land sinks. And you can again see a sink sustained throughout the first decade of this period and a progressively larger source in recent years, largely driven by 15 million hectares of mountain pine beetle impacts and very large fires in the last 2 years of the time series. So the question now is, how do we achieve mitigation? And what my work with the IPCC and subsequent work has always emphasized is that we need to take a systems perspective. And what I mean by that is that in the late 90s and early 2000s, when the Kyoto Protocol and issues around it were discussed, there was a lot of emphasis of how much carbon we can stack into ecosystems. And what the IPCC has said is that that is really the incomplete perspective. We must understand that through the use of forest products, we generate biofuels and long-lived wood products of different types and carbon retention duration. And with these products, we can meet services that are used by our society by substituting fossil fuels and other emissions-intensive products with these wood products. And we need to understand the net impact of these emissions on the atmosphere, these substitutions on the atmosphere. And similarly, if we expand forests into the non-forest land use, if we afforest, for example, and push agriculture out of its traditional uses, then that will have emission implications as well, either because the farmer goes somewhere else and deforests, or because farming intensity increases usually with more input from fossil fuels and fertilizers and also has emissions implications. And so what the IPCC said is it's not about how much carbon we can stack into ecosystems, but how we manage the land sector as a whole to minimize the net emissions to the atmosphere. And that's what I mean by a systems perspective. I would go one step further, although I will not be talking about that in more detail. When we go beyond greenhouse gas emissions, we must also recognize that surface characteristics of the forests change with our management decisions, and so the reflectance of sunlight changes. The most extreme example is afforestation in the north, where we have snow in the winter and dark conifer foliage in an afforested area. The energy balance is, of course, very different. And we're working on that, but I'm not talking about that today. So to reiterate, we must focus on the greenhouse gas balance, not stocks. If we design mitigation portfolios, we must account for the changes in the greenhouse gas balance in forested ecosystems and harvested wood products and the changes achieved through substitution benefits. And we need to do that relative to a base case. The debate that we see in British Columbia and Canada and in many other regions is the debate about how we best achieve climate change mitigation options. And some argue we need to achieve that through conservation. We must limit our harvest and use of bio wood products and instead allow to store as much carbon as possible in our forest ecosystems. And the alternate argument is that, no, this is the wrong perspective. We must find ways to maximize the carbon uptake. In other words, we want to achieve a contribution towards net zero emissions by managing the land sector such that we can take up and remove as much carbon from the atmosphere through forests and then keep it out of the atmosphere through our management strategies and wood product use strategies. And obviously, this is a debate that can be analyzed quantitatively, and then we can have conversations with stakeholders about what is the right place to do whichever action and design portfolios for mitigation accordingly. One of the important things of this to recognize is that you cannot at the same time have maximum carbon storage and maximum carbon uptake. While there is debate about the exact contribution of old growth forests as carbon sources or sinks, and there is plenty of evidence that old growth forests can be either carbon neutral or carbon sources, what is not debated is the general shape of the carbon sink dynamic. And that is that young and intermediate age forests have the highest carbon uptake rates, and old forests and very young forests that are recently disturbed have lower uptake rates. So we cannot simultaneously have a landscape that is either a maximum carbon sink or a maximum carbon store. If we store a lot of carbon in the landscape, our sink will diminish. If we want to have high sinks, the stock will diminish. And so this is what needs to be quantitatively analyzed. So how do we go about increasing forest carbon sinks? And this is really a global perspective initially, but of course, all of these things apply in British Columbia or in Oregon just at different rates. So the most important thing globally is the avoidance of deforestation, the conversion of forests to other land uses, such as cattle ranches and soybean plantations and so on. We have opportunities through increased afforestation and forest restoration, particularly in over 1 billion hectares of land around the world that is degraded through bad land management. And we have many opportunities through sustainable forest management, the increased use of long-lived wood products. And finally, particularly important in Western North America right now, we must choose actions that increase the forest resilience to climate change. The wildfire emissions that we've experienced are a huge problem. What is also important is that we must realize that each of these different options available to us has different timing in which the carbon benefits will be achieved. Avoided deforestation gives us a very short-term benefit, while increasing afforestation is a long-term benefit. We want to design portfolios that have a mix of short and long-term benefits so that we get the maximum long-term outcome. It's also important to recognize that there will be trade-offs. There are some activities that we can do to protect existing forest carbon stocks, but those actions may not enhance future carbon sinks, because if these forests are already at or near their carrying capacity, their ability to take up additional carbon will be very limited. So we need to quantify these benefits of our mitigation portfolios. We need to understand and look at the potential of a particular forested landscape to take up additional carbon, but we also must assess and evaluate the risks from climate change impacts. We've looked at some of these activities. Here on the left are a series of actions that we can do to bring about change in forest management. In the middle, we have things that we can do to through the management and use of wood products. And on the right-hand side, we have examples of substitution outcomes and substitution benefits. So we use our modeling framework to look at exactly these questions quantitatively. On the left, the carbon budget model that I briefly described earlier looks at the carbon stock changes in the ecosystems and the transfers to harvested wood products. A harvested wood products modeling framework that is conceptually very similar to what Todd described is used to track the annual carbon fate in harvested wood products and landfills, and we project that into the future. And then we also estimate the substitution benefits using life cycle analyses and other methodologies. The ecosystem and harvested wood products emissions are reported in our national inventory. The substitution impacts, where they are real, are also reported, but in other domestic sectors, say the transportation sector or the industrial sector, or in some cases, even in other countries where what we substitute is a product that was imported from abroad. Here is an example of a study that was conducted with our team at the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, where we looked at a series of mitigation strategies. And I don't have time to describe these all in detail, but there are, for example, there's one that is labeled residues. So that is, I don't know if you can see my cursor, this one here, which is basically the strategy that Todd described, where instead of slash pile burning post-harvest residues, these are used in the ecosystem, are extracted from the ecosystem and are used to produce bioenergy. And so the way you read these bars, and this is important, is that the green parts are the emission changes, reductions if below the zero line in the forest ecosystem. The red are the changes in emissions and harvested wood products. And the two blues are substitution benefits achieved through energy or product displacement. And so just staying for a moment at the residue one that I just mentioned, not burning slash in the forest means that we have less emissions from the forest, but this carbon is taken out of the forest and burned in the harvested wood product sector, in the energy sector. And so we get increased emissions in the energy sector, but we can use that to substitute energy and electricity and whatever, with a net benefit here of 11% of the projected emission reduction target for 2050. The important message here is that there are trade-offs, and that these different choices that we have, if we harvest less, for example, we can generate a small sink increase. We have fewer emissions in harvested wood products and in the ecosystem, but we have greater emissions through the products. And so what this shows us are the trade-offs, and going back to the original systems diagram, it helps us to understand how different mitigation actions influence the different components, the ecosystems, the biofuels, and the substitutions. What is important, now that we can do this, we can ask ourselves questions that if we take a strategy that is very much focused on putting more carbon in the ecosystem, we have the risk that this could be subject to future fire losses. On the other hand, if people don't like our substitution estimates, we can repeat the analysis with different displacement factors and see the sensitivity of the various outcomes towards the choice of emission factors. So it's a very powerful set of tools that allows us to conduct these analyses. And what we have learned from it is that what we do with the wood that we harvest matters greatly. The indicators we need to look at are the carbon retention time and the displacement factor. When we extract wood out of the harvest and turn it into bioenergy, we have very short carbon retention time and displacement factors that vary depending on what the material, what the energy sources that we're substituting. And that's why there are such big regional differences in the benefits of bioenergy. We have various other product categories that have longer retention times, increasingly longer retention times, and various displacement factors. But the holy grail, if you want, of this whole system is our structural building products, engineered wood products, that have both a long carbon retention time and a high displacement factor. And what the message from this is that if we have the choice to extract wood from the forest, we should aim to put it into products that have the longest carbon retention time and the highest displacement factors, and minimize the amount that we use for bioenergy or other materials that do not meet these goals in order to get great climate change mitigation benefits. And this is recognized around the world. There's a huge movement underway to build more mass timber buildings. In the middle, the tallest wooden building until recently, an 18-story building at the campus of the University of British Columbia. On the right-hand side, a planned 35-story wooden building, also in Vancouver, British Columbia. Innovation is key here. The ability to develop long-lived wood products that have high displacement factors, whether that is the innovative bridge design on the left, or new bioproducts, bioplastics, textiles, nanocellulose, and other types of engineered wood products, all of these are useful in enhancing the forest sector derived climate change mitigation benefits. And of course, they also have employment and other benefits. Reducing the amount of single-use plastics, for example, has many other environmental benefits. We just published a piece of work that my colleague Carolyn Smith has been leading with our team, looking at a spatially explicit province-wide analyses. We now have the capability to run all of British Columbia at 1 hectare spatial resolution and look at transportation distances. And we also looked at employment and cost curves of these different mitigation options. I don't have time to go into this. That alone would be a long presentation, but the link is in the presentation. So let me just say a few words on climate change impacts. These are, like other impacts, regionally differentiated. We know that climate change in some areas will enhance growth as a result of higher CO2, nitrogen deposition, or temperatures, while in others it will reduce growth or increase mortality rates. Pretty consistent, the forecasts are that decomposition rates will increase. Of course, for us in Canada, thawing permafrost, and for you in Alaska, that is a huge issue. Shifting vegetation zones are predicted and increased disturbances. Despite what some scientists say, I would suggest to you that at the moment, we are really not yet able to predict the net effects of all of these different changes that occur across the world or even across our respective countries. But what is important is for all of us to recognize there's an asymmetry of risk. Any carbon removed from the atmosphere is done so slowly, limited by tree growth rates. It can be emitted very quickly, as we have witnessed in forest fire emissions. And to put those into perspective, in British Columbia, as I said earlier, in 2017 and 18, we had about 3 million acres of wildfires in each of the 2 years. The emissions from that are in the order of, the direct emissions, are in the order of 200 million tons of CO2 equivalent in each of those 2 years. And that is three times the emissions from all other sectors of British Columbia combined in each of the 2 years. So put differently, if we design mitigation options in the forest sector that buy us 10 or 20 megatons in a particular year, if we have fires that release 200 megatons, that's an order of magnitude more in emissions. And the fires in British Columbia, as you heard earlier today, were not the only ones. When you look at this year in particular, I happened to be in Australia over Christmas this year and witnessed some of the extreme fires there. I just read the report from my colleagues in the Australian Greenhouse Gas Office. The 24 million hectares of bushfire, of which 7.5 million hectares were in temperate forests, are estimated to have emitted 940 megatons of CO2e. The Australian emissions from all other sectors are in the order of 500, so almost twice the emissions. In Russia, the data are still sparse. I've found some estimates of about a 250 million tons of CO2 emissions from peatland fires. Found a number for California, 2.2 million hectares with about 90 megatons of emissions. And fires in Oregon, Washington, Colorado are in some cases still burning, and we don't have the emissions yet. But what this highlights is that these wildfire emissions from just these four areas alone are over 1.2 billion tons of CO2. And that is in the order of 10% of the total global forest sink. Worse, wildfire risks will increase further with climate change. And so this is one of the reasons why I currently lead with colleagues from the Canadian Forest Service, the US Forest Service, University of British Columbia, Parks Canada, and the BC government, and funded by the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, a new project where we're asking whether there are ways in which we can combine climate change mitigation and adaptation solutions that are aimed at reducing the emissions from future wildfires while at the same time strengthening our BC-based bioeconomy. In other words, rather than allowing fuels to burn in the forest or using prescribed fires as the only management tool, can we use this biomass to help us drive a bioeconomy while also reducing future wildfire risks? So let me conclude with just a few simple statements. As I started out saying in this afternoon's presentation, if we want to keep temperature increases below 2 degrees centigrade, we must have net negative emissions before the end of the century, in other words, within the lifetime of children that are born today. That means we must drastically reduce the emissions in all sectors, in particular through fossil fuel use. But agricultural emissions will not go to zero. We will cause emissions through food production, and therefore we must have land sinks. So in other words, net zero and net negative are not achievable without greatly increasing forest sinks. But as I have just shown, these are at risk from climate change. The good news is we still have options. But it's also clear that the longer we delay our actions, the more severe the consequences will be. And with that, I thank you very much. There is my email address, and at the last slide, there are some references that describe some of the work that I've presented today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the material you've provided. I'll see if we have any questions from board members. Jim Kelly.
Not a question, just wanted to say that I just thought that was a wonderful presentation that, you know, as policymakers, that gives us a very holistic picture and was done in a way that I was able to understand. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate the feedback.